Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Dan Allen, who writes about issues of food, energy, and building resilience at the community level for resilience.org. I first heard about Mr. Allen during the interview with Keith Johnson. After reading some of Dan's articles, I wanted to interview him as a follow-up to the recently released conversation with Nicole Foss. Thankfully, Dan was up for it and replied quickly to set things up. During this conversation, we talk about his background as a scientist, his work as a teacher and farmer, why resilience matters, and what we can do to build it. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts on all this and how it relates to permaculture. If you like this and the other material from myself and the podcast, please consider supporting the show. Every bit of help you provide allows me to grow, expand, and share this information with an ever larger group of people. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to the interview with Dan Allen. Then, Mr. Allen, if you're ready, could you give us a little bit of your background and biography and how you came to be doing the work that you're doing?
My name is Dan Allen. I grew up in central New Jersey on a 100-acre farm. And, you know, even though it was sort of surrounding by a growing suburban sprawl, which was mostly arrested at this point now, you know, I grew up, we had animals and we did hay and, you know, I did the normal farm work you do growing up at a farm, but I was never that into it. I just ended up going to Gettysburg College, majoring in chemistry, ended up getting my PhD in chemistry. At this point, about partway through my PhD, I was becoming pretty disillusioned with industrial plan, you know, the culture, I guess. And I was reading a lot of like things like Noam Chomsky and things. So halfway through my PhD, I pretty much knew that something was very wrong and I didn't really want to participate in this culture, but I had no idea what to do. So I finished my PhD, you know, bounced around for a little while, worked for a little while in a pharmaceutical place, which was completely soul-crushing. I was just not able to do it, you know, mentally or, you know, emotionally or, you know, it just didn't work. It wasn't for me. And I started farming as a release, like just doing gardening stuff, even though I had never really been that into it growing up, even though I grew up on a farm. Anyway, then my brother was taking ecology classes in college, and I started reading his textbook, and I was like, oh, you know, this is it. So I went back and took some ecology classes, got married, so I had to get a real job. So I started teaching high school chemistry. But, you know, that leaves me with a lot of time to do farming stuff, which I really enjoy.
How much land are you farming right now?
My parents' farm is 100 acres. I have 6 acres. My sister has 10 acres. We're pretty much bounce around between those three farms, which, you know, the majority is still in hay and parts of it are wooded, but I'm sort of gradually expanding a permaculture type plan, planting a lot of fruit and nut trees, we still do about a half acre annual garden, and we have a farm stand at the end of the driveway, which is pretty much what I do in the summer along with my tree planting and things like that.
So your summer job, you leave the classroom and you go and become a farmer?
That's right. And actually the farming is sort of creeping in. Well before the school year ends, I'm already sort of in full-blown farming mode. And even when school picks up again in September, I still have a couple months of pretty busy farming months. So I'm a teacher and farmer, but the farmer sort of creeping out into the teaching. Then, you know, I teach chemistry, which isn't totally high school chemistry, which all this ecology farming stuff has tangential relationships to. But I talk about it an awful lot in class. Even though the kids are, for the most part, wildly uninterested in it. It's funny. They're usually you get about maybe a couple kids a year who latch on to the permaculture or ecology stuff I talk about, but the rest of them are just like, okay, what do I have to know for the test when I get into college? That's it.
Does New Jersey have any environmental education requirements that would kind of link together the work that you're doing with chemistry and farming and ecology with biology and the other classes?
Where I could actually teach the ecology permaculture stuff in high school, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. There's any, like, environmental, I don't know what they call it, AP environmental science or something like that. And all those are in the biology curriculum, and I'm, you know, quote unquote, qualified to teach chemistry and physics. So that's not an option for me to teach that in the current way they do things. But I really try to incorporate all this stuff into the chemistry curriculum as much as possible, but it's nowhere close to what it would be if you could actually go into it in detail. I have a permaculture club, which I started, and, you know, it is a couple kids come a week, but I just started it, so I think it's something that'll grow. But in that venue, I can really go into stuff, and the kids are pretty into it, and it's really neat when you find someone that it latches on with. So, yeah, nothing formal, I guess.
Do you ever take any of your students out to the farm?
Yeah, we have a couple kids from high school who help out in the garden on the farm during the summer, sort of like paid interns we have. Otherwise, I started this community garden as well, which sort of mirrors my half-acre annual garden, along with like a sort of a growing fruit and nut tree orchard. And high school kids do come out to that one as well, just completely voluntarily. I think it fulfills some sort of college application volunteering requirement or something. Between 3 and 5 kids a year are actively participate in the community garden. Another 10 or so live not too far away from our farm, and they tell me that their parents always buy stuff from the farm and stuff like that. So there's a relationship, some interweaving of the kids and the farming stuff.
Is it this deep interest in farming as an adult, this place of respite that you found, combined with your background in science, that brought you to the viewpoint that you have that led you to write articles for resilience?
You know, I think so. It's from a pretty young age, I've always been, even though I just sort of went along with the sort of cultural directive of do well in high school, you know, get into college, do well in college, eventually going up for a job and trying to get a better job. And I was in that plan for a while. I've always had a sort of deep uneasiness of everything that's going on, pollution-wise, and the things that directly affected me as growing up were, you know, things like, you know, pollution and suburban sprawl that I could just feel were wrong. And my mom's currently the mayor of this town, and her life work has been the stopping of suburban sprawl and protection of farmland in our township. You know, that's always been in me, that sort of environmental consciousness from that. And, you know, I never had much grounding in ecology, so it was sort of a nebulous, you know, not defined as it is now. I think what happened is my science training allowed me to really understand the energetic issues as far as like fossil fuels, the climate issues, things like nuclear issues that always sort of worried me. But now I, with my science background, I feel I have a very good grasp of them. I feel I understand them. So, and that combined with taking ecology classes, primarily, I think, with David and Joan Ehrenfeld at Rutgers, really sort of everything sort of crystallized where, you know, I had this ecological sort of conscience, but now it's really grounded in, you know, how everything works ecologically, plus the hard science of it, combined now with what I feel is probably the, you know, the primary issue facing us, which is, you know, how do we grow food moving forward from here? How do we grow food in a climate that's falling apart? How do we grow food with all these toxins flying around? How do we grow food without fossil fuels when that's the only way people know how to grow food at this point? I think it is a combination of all that. That maybe gives me not a unique viewpoint on all this, but something that, a way to look at the issues from many angles, you know, and understand them from many angles. That's why I write the articles, because I feel like, I sort of understand this stuff, and I want other people to understand it, and trying to make a future that's less bleak than it otherwise could be, and not just less bleak, but, you know, where we can actually thrive. I think it's as difficult as things are going to turn out, it's possible in certain pockets to thrive, and I want to try to make those pockets be as numerous and large as they could be.
Your formal background as a scientist allows you to have an informed viewpoint, and then your abilities as a teacher allow you to relay these very complex ideas to others in a way that makes sense. You might not have the same background in training.
Right, right. You know, there's just so much contradictory information on all this. like a high school kid who doesn't really understand the nuts and bolts of the climate. Scientists, you know, James Hansen says things have the potential to get very, very bad. It looks like they're going to get very, very bad. And to a high school kid, that gets canceled out by someone saying, you know, not just the deniers, but the people who say, yeah, you know, stuff will get, it'll be okay, you know, things will be okay. They don't have the background to discern which is the more, you know, weighty view there. Unfortunately, in most cases, the more weighty view is the one that's most alarming, both, you know, in climate, energy, the whole nuclear fuel situation. Anyway, I think, you know, just my ability to understand it, to really pick out the truth from the lies, so to speak, or even beyond that, the most important parts of the truth, the things that are going to be most crucial moving forward. I think that's what I'm able to do, I guess. Or, you know, I like to think I am.
Well, one of the things that you touched on there about what is weighty and carries the most, like, value for a message, a lot of times I find that there's a difference between what's being released in the research papers versus what the popular material is on a given subject versus what we're hearing in the news, that even though there may be a lot of evidence on one side of things, by the time that it makes it to popular communication, you have two people who are discussing the topic and they're both given equal time and equal weight in the conversation.
Yeah, it just turns the whole thing into a meaningless exercise. I mean, it just, there's things that are going on right now that can't wait. You know, every day that goes on, the future of the climate becomes bleaker. Every day that goes on, that where we don't start, you know, turning our agriculture into something that can work without fossil fuels, the coming convulsions become more, you know, worse and worse. So this sort of debating whether it's happening or not, or, you know, whether the economy is going to collapse or whether the climate's going to destabilize, it just ends up being, you know, really something pretty disastrous. Just the fact that it delays everything, you know, delays the obvious things that we should do. You know, it's a tough problem. And in my opinion, there's not going to be a solution in the political realm. You know, there's people are too good at skirting around the issues. They're too good at keeping any of the changes from happening. So, I mean, in my opinion, the best case scenario is, you know, the economy goes down. As painful as that is, I don't see a stepwise solution to the climate and the energy predicaments that we're in that occurs in time to prevent catastrophe. In other words, if we waited for all these debates to play out, we're done. So the best case scenario for me is, or, you know, in my opinion, is the whole thing goes down and we're forced to, you know, sort of adjust on the fly. What I'm trying to do in the articles and what I try to do in class when I'm talking to the kids is sort of lay the groundwork for the kind of thinking that's going to be required when all the stuff goes down. When all of a sudden they wake up and, oh, you know, fossil fuels aren't available, or they're only difficultly available. Or what happens when I wake up and, you know, there's no food in the supermarket. Climate's going haywire. What kind of tools are we going to need moving forward here? And the kind of tools that we're going to need are anywhere from the mental tools to sort of deal with all these changes, and the physical tools, the varieties of plants that we're going to need moving forward and to do a sort of agriculture that works in this crazy world that we're making. I was thinking, it's sort of all, what my main focus here is to try to, and I think the thing that's most important moving forward for everyone here has to do with relationships. And in the sense that when everything goes down, when everything changes, and I know it's not going to happen, you know, in a blink of an eye, and it's going to be probably happen a sort of stepwise way, but those steps can be pretty severe. And the sort of relationships that are going to be crucial are, first of all, within ourselves. Like, am I going to be a useful, helpful person moving forward here when everything changes? You know, if I define myself by my job, which I think so many people do, like, and my job is to push buttons and or to move widgets around in cyberspace, as soon as my job goes away, what, you know, what good am I? And I think Dmitry Orlov talks a lot about that in the sense that when collapse happens, a lot of people just find themselves completely useless. So the first thing is the relationship of yourself. You know, get good with yourself. Be a useful person. David Ehrenfeld used to say in ecology class, learn to do something useful. you know, along with all the other stuff that you have to do in your life. So that's one. The other is, you know, the relationships with your family, get good with that, whether they're related to you or not, you know, some sort of family unit. Relationships with your community, get to know your neighbors. Relationship with the land, learn what's there. Learn the birds and the trees. Learn about the food plants. Learn about the soil. In more than just a scientific way, like, establish a relationship, you know, and Derek Jensen, his work is key here, I think, you know, in his, what he talked about in his book, Dreams. But really, there's, you know, a much deeper relationship with the land is possible than pretty much anybody has in this culture. And starting to cultivate that relationship, you know, talking to the trees and birds, you know, as ridiculous as that seems, is not silly. It's something that people have done for as long as people were people, and we've only stopped doing recently. So all those relationships are what's going to be important moving forward here. And I think that's, or, you know, I hope that's in my articles and when I talk to the kids in class, that's the kind of thing I want to establish as something that's important.
You mentioned events happening in a way that it's kind of a step down from where we are.
Like a stepwise collapse, yeah.
Because of that, do you think that we'll reach a point where we'll look back only after everything's happened and see the way that we got to where we were that'll be so slow that it kind of creeps up on us? Or do you think that there's a likelihood of larger events kind of waking more people up to these possibilities?
I certainly think that there's the potential for larger events to make it feel really not like just a stepwise collapse, you know? I mean, take Fukushima. I mean, Fukushima could have been and still can be so much worse than it was. And it was disastrous. You know, it still is disastrous. Something 10 times worse than Fukushima could happen today in New York, you know, Indian Point, which would render, you know, huge swaths of land uninhabitable. And then if that doesn't wake people up, I mean, things can happen which will be unimaginable things could happen. Something can happen in the climate that is unimaginable to people. You know, a Category 5 hurricane going through Midtown Manhattan or so, you know, something like that. Those things can happen, and all of a sudden things are completely different than they were. But I think what happens is that people just adjust to the new reality. Okay, what's it like? You know, my dog just died. He got run over by a car. He got run over by a car. And 1 minute we're laughing and, you know, things are like they are when you have all fun and everything. The next minute, we're holding the dog in our arms, crying. You know, I told my 8-year-old daughter, it's hard. You know, there's good things and bad things in life. And immediately, boom, we're in a new reality. Granted, a very small example, but all of a sudden, things are completely different. And you just adjust to the new way things are. And I think that's what we're going to do. And however, what we're going to need are some tools when things change. And it's pretty clear the way things are going to turn out, you know, the direction things are moving in. We're going to have to learn to do stuff without fossil fuels. We're going to have to adapt to growing food where the weather is just weird. And sometimes the weather doesn't cooperate at all. And sometimes most of the food plants that we're used to don't produce anything in a given year. You know, that's the kind of reality we're moving to. And we're going to need the tools to deal with that. So you mentally adapt to any change. You know, catastrophes are happening all over the world all the time, and they happen, and people deal with it. But my focus here is that they're going to need the tools to deal with it as best as they can. And that's what I'm trying to get for my family, for my community, the tools of how do you grow food without fossil fuels? How do you establish a relationship with the land and with each other in a way that's not damaging or abusive? So yes, I think people are going to adapt, whether it happens in a slow fashion or a big jump down, but they're going to need the tools to adapt, and that's as best as possible.
Well, as I was reminded, it's not really a matter of if something happens, it's a matter of when it happens, and that we have the mental capacity to really deal with change and internalize it and just kind of adapt to what's happening. But that the next step is being able to have the actual physical tools to function well in the new reality.
Right. So all of a sudden, you know, fossil fuels become hard to get and the climate's acting funny. And we say, okay, we finally get it. You know, the majority of people wake up, okay, we finally get it. We're going to need a new way to do agriculture because obviously this way isn't working because we're having, you know, failed yield after failed yield here. What do we do? And then what do you do if you don't have the cultivars, if you don't have the species of food trees around you that possibly have a chance? What do you do if, like, if you don't recognize the wild plants all around you that are edible, but you have no idea what they are? You know, I just read Sam Thayer's books, absolutely brilliant books on, you know, wild plants, what they are, how to prepare them, that sort of thing. Just crucial information moving forward here. So yeah, when people finally wake up to the fact that we're going to have to do agriculture differently, they're going to need to know those things. And all these plants are completely useless if nobody knows that they exist, or, you know, what they are, or how you would possibly eat this plant, you know, what parts of it are edible. I try to plant as many different kinds of fruit and nut trees and shrubs and perennial vegetables and annual vegetables as possible. I could make more money at our farm stand, I think, if I grew only the ones people want. But what I'm trying to do here is, you know, in my little part of the world that I can control, to try to get the parts in place where moving forward, maybe we have a chance to adapt to what's coming. Maybe. I'm under no illusions that I'm making my farms collapse and climate catastrophe proof, because they might not be. You know, there's nuclear reactors not that far from here. You know, we might be forced off the land at some point. You know, I don't know. But I'm trying to give us the best shot we have.
I live a short drive from Three Mile Island, so I understand the nuclear side of things to a degree. It sounds like what you're recommending then is a multi-tiered approach to preparing for what lies in the future, to educate ourselves, to reconnect with our community, and then within the landscape to build multiple tiers of resiliency so that if there's a catastrophe of any one kind, there's at least something there to help back that up.
Right. So many things can go wrong. You just try to give yourself and your family and your community the best chance to weather them. And the thing is that in fashioning such a farm, I'm only, you know, a small part of the way there to the kind of farms that I want to have around me here and in my community. But in fashioning that kind of, you know, diverse, sort of ecologically balanced farms that have a lot of, you know, a lot of hand labor going on, a lot of people doing different things, it really sounds a lot like the way it should be. I mean, it sounds like something that's right. It feels like something that's right. When everybody in my family is working on harvesting the peaches or something like that, and everybody is, you know, working and saying how great they are, and everyone's laughing and having a good time, and it just feels right. And I've been around industrial agriculture, you know, and in the industrial culture to know it feels wrong. You know, it feels bad. It's something wrong. It's something very wrong about it. And, you know, a great many people can feel this, whether they, you know, really sort of acknowledge what the problem is there, that it feels wrong. So, I mean, the added benefit of increasing your resiliency is really you're making a life that I really think human beings were meant to live, you know, around other people, or like in a tight community, around a lot of different kinds of plants and animals, the ground covered by vegetation and not barren swaths of dirt. You know, this is how we're meant to live, and it just so happens that that also gives us the best chance to live, I think, in time moving forward.
As people cultivating the land, we cultivate a community and ourselves.
Right, if you do it right. There's a way to cultivate the land and destroy the land and destroy ourselves and destroy our communities, and that's the way we've been doing it. But there's a way to, you know, quote-unquote, cultivate the land and do it different. There'll be places where all the pieces are in place enough where people can, you know, cultivate the land in a good way moving forward. And there'll be places where they can't. You know, there'll be places where maybe the critical mass of people who have the required information or are not in place, and it's, you know, then those places will blink out. And I'm just trying to make my place somewhere that's not going to blink out, somewhere that maybe, you know, maybe has a chance to thrive I can feel that it's possible. Walking out in the orchard or walking out around the pond, it's just feels right, you know? It feels like something that's good.
And the more that these kinds of conversations are had and that people connect with this information and what's going on, the more pockets of stability that can be created, the more islands of resiliency that can exist.
And then, you know, climate willing, those pockets can grow. You know, all you need is a seed. People being born and coming of age all the time, and it makes a difference whether those people are, quote unquote, inoculated with the death-dealing culture, with a destructive culture, with an abusive culture, or inoculated with a culture of, you know, nurturing. And in those pockets that survive will be the ones with, hopefully, at least that survive for a long extended period, will be the nurturing cultures. And hopefully that'll spread. Hey, it's worth a shot, right? Bad things can happen, but good things can happen. And my time on Earth is going to be spent fighting like heck to try to, you know, give the good things a chance.
What are some of the things that are providing a lot of encouragement and inspiration for you as you continue to do your work?
You know what? When I talk about it in my high school classes, you know, I love my kids, but they're just so indoctrinated with the industrial culture. You know, no fault of their own. It's just where they are. And it's heartbreaking to see that. You know, when I talk about some of the things I talk about, you know, the Derek Jensen, David Ehrenfeld sort of stuff, and just to see it just pass right over their heads because they're thinking about the next test or something. But the thing that really heartens me is it's not all of them. They're a small percentage of them. They get it. And not because they've had prior exposure to it or something. It's just something that clicks in some people. And seeing that click in some people, seeing that click in kids, you know, in smaller kids, in my nieces and nephews and children, seeing it click sometimes in them is what makes me think, you know, it has a chance. Where it's a case of give children good mental food and they have a chance to flourish. You give them bad mental food and they're going to do what we've been doing for the past 200 years, you know.
But your role as a teacher in their life helps to guide them in a place where they can make the next round of differences in the world.
Yeah, I think, like I said, it's worth a shot. No guarantees here. The other thing that gives me hope is, or, you know, makes me feel, encourages me, is just to see how the land responds when you treat it well. Just to see that, Derek Jensen says, life wants to live. Just being able to see that if you don't continually abuse a piece of land, something good happens. You know, things multiply. Things get more bountiful. Things get more beautiful. That is just so encouraging. You know, just the amazingness of this world, where if you're not actively trying to kill it, it wants to live. That's encouraging. And, you know, the same thing goes for children. If you're not feeding them all this consumer nonsense, they can turn into something really great. You know, they can do really great things.
As a parent of two small children who have been raised largely outside of a commercial childhood, my children have seen very, very little advertising, not a lot of commercials through television or magazines or anything like that. We've been very selective about media. And the difference that makes when we go to a store, we had an example one time of one morning, my wife turned on the television. There was a normal program that we would sit and watch with our children. My wife turned it on as we were processing everybody to get ready in the morning. And she didn't realize that when she turned it on that the program was actually on broadcast television, not through one of the services we use to stream without commercials. And my children saw some commercials that morning before we went to the store. And it was like every end cap of every aisle in the store was everything they had seen in the commercials that morning. It was the only time I've ever seen my children where it's like, Daddy, I want that, I want that, I want that. And it's like, okay, let's go down this aisle and walk around the outside of the store so they don't see these things. It was awful.
Yeah, you know, they tapped into something very real in humans that's very bad. You know, evolutionarily ingrained desire for to be tricked or, you know, to want stuff or to want whatever it is. It's in us. It's something that's in us, and it's something that the worst part of us is being exploited and made to be our entire self. That's the culture we're in. It's not all of us. It doesn't have to be a big part of us. It wouldn't be a big part of us if we weren't continually being tricked. Being embedded in this culture, it's hard to get away from it, yeah.
But we can make the choices so that we can step away from it and not have to participate in it in the same way. And I think of what you were saying about building community and things, I do believe in local community and small-scale organization. And I think if we turn away from some of the larger structures and focus just on ourselves and our local community, that we can make a lot of a difference without having to continue to be part of the same myths and the same stories of the broader consumptive, destructive society.
Yeah. I don't hold a lot of hope for, you know, national sort of movements or, you know, international movements that would make a difference. The forces are too powerful at that level, and things are going to play out like they're going to play out, you know, constrained by the energy depletion and the climate craziness and all the economic swindles that are falling apart. You know, that's what's going to move things on the national, international scale. And you're right. I think that where we can make the difference is establishing these pockets of sanity, establishing these pockets, you know, of resiliency, where you have the ideas in place, trying to establish these relationships in your community with the land, get some species down, get some roots in the ground. You know, that's the difference we can make. And you do that, you get 10,000 little pockets in the United States, and those are the ones that are going to grow when all this other nonsense evaporates, when the corporations dissolve back into hell where they came from, you know, when the federal government is completely neutered by, you know, a resource depletion, and those pockets then can grow. And, you know, that's where we can make a difference on the small scale. We do what we can. It's hard because all the forces that are beating it down are still in place. As much as I love my teaching job, as much as I love the kids, I really wish I could do this farming stuff full time. You know, I plant trees 24/7, you know, so much I want to do that I don't have time for because I'm still embedded in this culture. And there's it's hard for me to get out. And, you know, you have family things, family obligations, and, you know, not everybody's on the complete same page as you, but we do what we can do.
By you and I sitting down and having this conversation and sharing it with the listeners, they get to hear someone else's voice that can be used to communicate these ideas to others. We keep the people who are already connected and plugged in continually inspired so that they can move forward. But also when they hear a story from someone, perhaps someone hears about you are farming part-time or that you're in New Jersey and decides to reach out to you because they know someone who's in New Jersey who might find inspiration in what you're doing. And then that brings someone else who wasn't connected before along for the ride, and we slowly build the people who are interested by bringing more and more in from the fringe.
That's one of the reasons I really love the community garden we have in our town. It's so neat to see people who are, for the million reasons for joining it, but to see them show up and they're like, wow, you know, this is where a potato comes from. Wow, that's so neat. This is asparagus. That's so neat. Just to see the start of something that can really grow into something really great. You know, it's like so many people are functionally autistic to the natural world. It just doesn't matter to them. They have no reason to know anything about any plants or birds or their food or anything. But it's not a permanent condition. It can be awakened, you know, that sort of wonder, that sort of relationship. And yeah, it's neat to see that growing in people. And I think, again, I think it's the natural, it's the way we are. They have to really beat it out of us. They have to really trick us into not establishing relationship with the land. And they're very good at it. You know, all this advertising and culture and everything, very good at ripping us apart from the land. Given a chance, though, that's where we want to be. That's where we want to go back to. That's what feels good, mosquitoes aside, but is that relationship. And it's just wonderful to see it awakening in people. And yeah, that's what I try to do. I try to give my high school kids a chance to reawaken that sort of consciousness in them that's there that they don't know. To, you know, people at the community garden, to reawaken it there. You know, even at the farm stand where we sell our stuff from our garden at the end of the driveway, you see people saying, wow, you know, this is so great. You just get food here, just right down the street from me. You can get all the food I need. This is so great. That sort of thing. It's it was really heartening, you know.
I'll be going off to meet some of my local farmers to pick up some food here later today. So.
Nice, nice.
I like that relationship, getting to know my farmers, their names, and know how much land they're farming and what their practices are. Well, Mr. Allen, thank you for sitting down and having this conversation with me. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, other than just keep trying, you know? Keep pushing ahead. It's not easy sometimes, but it's the only thing we can do. And things look bleak sometimes, but hey, maybe it's going to be okay. Maybe in certain places, certain times, it's going to be okay. And the thing that we can do is try to give it the best chance to be okay. And there's a lot of things we can do, and there's a lot of things we need to do. And so let's do them. Let's reconnect. You know, let's reconnect to everything. Reconnect to each other. Reconnect to the land. Let's do that.
We'll certainly do what we can to work on building a better world. Thank you, sir, for joining me today.
Oh, thank you.
And that was Dan Allen. What stands out to me from this conversation is that need to build little pockets of local resilience and to reach out to people who have an interest in doing so. Dan does that with some of his students through the community garden and his farm stand. As practitioners of permaculture, we can do that by building functional systems that show people examples that work and share our surplus as it arises to connect with others. Also, you've heard in some of the interviews recently, and we'll hear again in upcoming ones, about the need to move beyond gardening or the backyard and design our support structures and community to expand our networks, to observe the places where we live, the people there, and to meet them where they're at, to find the people already in line with our goals and designs, and to help them build their own, to make small changes that engage without overwhelming, to show people what is possible by investing in what matters to us, rather than continuing the cycle of take, make, and waste. I admit it's not easy, but together, we can make it happen. I'll be here along the way. Will you join me? If so, I'd love to hear from you. Or if you have questions about your next step and what to do, feel free to contact me. By email, the address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call, 717-827-6266. You can also send me a message on Facebook through the page for the show at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or on Twitter where I am @permaculturecst. Or if you want to go the old-fashioned way, you can even send me a letter. That address is The Permaculture Podcast, P.O. Box 16, Dauphin, D-A-U-P-H-I-N, Pennsylvania, which is abbreviated PA, 17018-0016, USA. Over the next few weeks, we'll be the interview with Wilson Alvarez and Ben Wise on Zone 4 Permaculture, and Michael Polarski on the intersection between the wild and the managed in permaculture. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other, and the legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share it. Just tell people where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.